everybody. It's Joseph Loudon, Joe Loud Guy here on Sociable Socialism. I'm glad to be recording again. Well, not glad. I'm not glad. I obviously haven't recorded in over a month at this point. If you've been a listener of the show, you know, I deeply appreciate you sticking with it. You know, even tuning in just to see what I'm up to. I really appreciate that. You have no idea. I've been trying to find something to put my energy towards now that Bernie's campaign has fallen apart. I was very invested in it, and losing it has been one of my fires that kind of got extinguished with politics. And of course, today I'm recording, even though I wasn't expecting to, breaking my silence because Michael Brooks has died, and it was sudden. And it surprised me, among others. And I'm going to talk about how he impacted my life and probably share some clips of Michael's that I took partial fondness towards. And I appreciate everybody for tuning in.
all season.
Let's do another very damning. Pete Buttigieg is like the Lib Dems of the United States. I've decided, I think we all agreed, and did everybody basically agree in Philadelphia that
Pete's the worst?
Pete's the worst.
Oh, yeah. He's definitely worse than Biden.
Literally not a candidate up there I wouldn't vote for over Pete. I couldn't think of. Because this is serious, because it's not just, it's, one, as Crystal Ball pointed out, there's something just so devastatingly depressing about somebody so young repeating so much pablum and bullshit. But it's also that, look, if we take some horrifying, depressing scenario like Joe Biden, it is anything besides Bernie's a setback, if we're being real. And then it's just a degree of setback. But Pete Buttigieg represents generations defining reassertion of failed hegemony and failed ideas. And I think that this is really important. I mean, this clip is from 2011, and these clips are not, you know, Pete Buttigieg's record on race is not the product of somebody who didn't use woke terminology or needs to be educated on certain policy sets. This is somebody who actually has been involved in issues with regards to race, policing, gentrification, and here has an attitude on education that show that he clearly, sincerely, and horrifyingly wrongly diagnosed things. This is Pete Buttigieg from 2011.
You know, the kids need to see evidence that education is going to work for them, right? You so go. You see a lot of parts of
that's
town.
That's part of the motivation.
Where, yeah, because you're motivated because you believe that at the end of your educational process, there's a reward, there's a stable life, there's a job. And there are a lot of kids, especially the lower income minority neighborhoods, who literally just haven't seen it work. There isn't somebody they know personally
and I think that's
who testifies to the value of education. So, yeah,
meet that person.
You bet. You know, the kids need to.
So let's just be really clear, because I tweeted this out and I saw some people still get, I mean, it's amazing, honestly, that some people could be following me and still be so delusional. He is speaking about people, and I don't know what the broader context of this question is, so I won't make it, you know, let's say people from any community that are experiencing poverty and lack of social mobility, right? Let's say that's who he's speaking to. I would be shocked if it wasn't. I mean, this discourse was normal racialized across the board. I just heard a clip of Sam Harris saying something like this the other, like asking a guy if, you know, doing it well at school was acting white or something. So the point is that the reason that people are having trouble at school and having trouble moving up a ladder is because the entire economic and political deck is stacked against them on a material level, not because they don't have positive role models. And by the way, not because also you don't go to a very wide variety of circumstances and background and you don't actually meet incredibly well-read, highly educated people, because this is a whole other subtext, barely subtext, that we're confusing testing and accreditation with intellectual acumen They're absolutely, they might have overlap in some cases, but they're absolutely not the same thing. And secondly, and thirdly, education does not solve poverty. Poverty is a resource and distributional problem. And this is a scam that conservatives and neoliberals have been running for decades, which is that we can deindustrialize, we can totally hack the safety net, we can have no public provisions for housing and healthcare that are real, substantive, and sustainable. We can redline people, we can racially discriminate against them, we can box in resources, and then all we need is, well, not, and then of course we need to terrorize the teachers and the teachers' unions, but we just need somebody to see somebody from their neighborhood get educated and do well. I'll tell you this, I know for a fact that you can hear countless stories of people from different backgrounds saying, I actually do know X, Y, or Z person who did do quote unquote all of the right things you're supposed to do. They did get degrees, they did do this, and now they're basically just swimming in debt.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. That's mainly the upshot. Larger number.
That's by far the larger number. And then the last point, really quick, too, is like, what kind of disgusting system do we have to be in that when you finally do meet? I mean, if you go to a private college or an Ivy League campus or even some good state university campuses, you will meet people who are like, I'm upper middle class, usually white, not always, but always upper middle class, if not rich. And they're normal people. They're not dumb. They're not brilliant. And they're there. And there's a lot of them there. And they work. And they live in certain neighborhoods. And they got paid. They got trained in certain ways to take certain tests. And they got certain, recommendations. And then you will meet somebody from, Appalachia or an inner city or somewhere like that is not racially geographically represented, and you'll meet them and you're like, oh, that person is a fucking genius usually, and also lucked out because they had one guidance counselor or like literally had absolutely astoundingly above average talent and then had several lucky breaks. So basically all this is doing is, I mean, it sounds like boring, stupid pablum, but really what it is systemic and aggressive victim blaming. And there's nothing in this guy's record that I have seen that would attest otherwise to any other policy views. Now, look, that's a 25-second clip. So maybe the rest of the debate will come out and he'll say, we need to get jobs, we need to get healthcare, we need to deal with policing, we need to deal with racism. This is very much something that you need to sort of add in today's world because there's a million different clips floating around of people. But that one discrete clip, he said what he said. And that is a destructive myth in that 25 seconds. Unless it was immediately preceded by, I would be a fucking McKinsey asshole to say.
Yeah, it's dangerous. And I don't know if Pete Buttigieg really has any beliefs to speak of because he has pivoted around so much and shown himself to have no inner core. But if there's anything he sincerely believes in, it's probably the American meritocracy because he is a child of privilege who jumped through the hoops and took the tests, and everything is set up to convince these people, oh, now you've earned the right to run the world.
Right.
Like, I've been through the gauntlet. I know exactly how it works and what it's like. And it really does. It can trick you because you're like, oh, yeah, I'm working really hard. Therefore, I must deserve this.
Right.
There's more lines of evidence that Pete Buttigieg is a racist than that black people don't support him because they're homophobic.
Well, indeed, without a doubt.
I'm sorry, David, did you put this article in there?
Yeah, I have it. Okay. You want me to pull it up on the screen?
Yeah, let's pull it up. So basically, you know, very good news. Jamal Bowman defeated Elliot Engel. And Elliot Engel was chair of the House Foreign Relations Committee. And of course, this was a major, I mean, he probably lost to Bowman because he was hanging out in Maryland as COVID ravaged through his district, because at a Black Lives Matter rally, he made sure to say not just once, but twice, that he needed speaking time and he wouldn't normally care, but he was facing a tough primary. But some of the issues that did come up and then, you know, were obviously, I mean, actually Engel had moved sort of in a more progressive direction domestically. He co-sponsored Medicare for All, but Bowman clearly is, you know, obviously much more committed and has a dynamism and a leadership to him that Engel is lacking. Foreign policy was there too. Elliot Engel voted for the invasion of Iraq. He opposed the Iran deal. He supported absolutely any Israeli policy, any violation of Palestinian territories, anywhere, anytime, any place. Pure far-right AIPAC guy, and also an instrument on Latin America. Coup mongering against Venezuela, you know, supporting military cooperation with the Bolsonaro government in Brazil. Now, I, you know, Just Foreign Policy, which people should check out, looks like, you know, there's a conflict now between who will be the next chair of the committee and the sort of more center-left progressive sort of foreign policy side is lining up behind Joaquin Castro. Now, I'm not enamored of the Castro brothers by any stretch of the imagination. But this is an important one to watch for a variety of reasons. And I'll just give you a brief introduction. And I'll tell you, I definitely think that Joaquin Castro, who, by the way, I said I'm not enamored. I mean, he's done some good things as well. And certainly what he's indicating is significant compared to the two other options. So we have Brad Sherman and Gregory Meeks. I want to talk about Brad Sherman first. Could you scroll down a bit, David? This is actually really interesting because Sherman at first blush is very much in the Engel mode. He's very right wing in many respects. He voted for the invasion of Iraq. I think he also opposed the Iran deal. Just a bit more, David. Okay. I just want to find the Sherman section. Yes, okay, so here it is. Sherman, the most senior member of the committee, but he's ruffled some Democratic colleagues, I'm quoting from the Washington Post, in the past. Like Engel, he voted for the Iraq war and opposed the Iran nuclear deal. This is interesting. I definitely support Castro, but I want to hear Castro's comment on this. In an interview, Sherman acknowledged his hawkish record on Middle East policy, but underscored his more liberal outlook on what may be the most consequential foreign policy challenge of the 21st century, the U.S. relationship with China. That's true. Scroll down. This is very interesting. The Pentagon needs a worthy adversary to justify a huge increase in budget, and China is it, Sherman said. He said the defense industry and other foreign policy hawks inflate the threat posed by China's construction of artificial islands and overstate the danger to international shipping in the South China Sea. Whenever the Pentagon has faced an irregular force, it's been a miserable experience, he said, referring to militias and terrorist groups. But whenever our military has faced a symmetrical, uniformed opponent, it's just been glorious. So it's not surprising the Pentagon is looking for a symmetrical opponent to justify a bigger budget. Now, Sherman's record is really not good, but I got to say that is important as hell. Because the tension with China and the justification of those military budgets is going to be the predominant thing right now, and it must be fought against. It's enormously dangerous. I'm sorry, David, could you pull that article up?
Yeah.
So that's something to note and something to ask Castro about. Now, Meeks, he was right on Iraq. He was right on the nuclear deal. On the other hand, bad on Venezuela and also, you know, connected, I would say, a big advocate of corporate written trade deals. I think he's, you know, And the article presents him. He's an effective politician. He's well-liked, but totally inside the corporate Democratic Party. He's not going to ruffle any feathers. Let me just down to Castro. What are you laughing at?
This line. This is like high school. You want to be good at making friends.
Mr. Meeks is effective at that. I mean, Meeks is going to be in a strong position. Castro, the most junior member seeking the position, said it's overdue for the committee to reexamine its mission and not shy away from challenging politically powerful interests and rolling back America's military commitments. Our Foreign Affairs Committee needs to catch up with where Democrats are in foreign policy, he said. Over the years, there have been many, I'm assuming that's too many voices excluded. I think too often Palestinian voices have been excluded. If the United States is going to be an arbiter for peace, it has to be willing to hear from a different side. In my estimation, we've not always done that. So, I mean, that's completely obvious to everybody. That's still a significant statement for somebody who wants to be chair of foreign relations. I mean, that's not what somebody's saying when they want to get that gavel a couple years ago. So we'll continue covering this. And I know that there's some left energy around Castro. Want to hear the China statements as well, because that's significant. Brad Sherman has an awful record with regards to Iraq, Iran, and the broader Middle East, but he's accurate about China. And of course, Castro talking about reinvent, and there was another segment of the article where he talked about reimagining the purpose of the committee. Let's get back to diplomacy. Let's think outside military terms. That's, of course, of core importance. And I know that some of the energy around him is thinking very constructively with regards to the Middle East and Latin America in particular. I want to know a debt relief agenda. I want to know an Africa agenda. And then, of course, the ecology embedded in all of it, as well as labor rights. You guys have anything to add on that?
I mean, it's just that, it's definitely, it's interesting. I mean, this is just a general note. I think the terrain is definitely shifting. I mean, we're seeing it. It's going to be curious, the terrain and just the way that what people signal when they want to come into power, whether or not that's going to mean material changes is one thing. But we're going to have to learn to reacquaint ourselves with buzzwords and things of that nature. Because I do think that the way that politicians is changing, I think that there's been a shift that doesn't necessarily mean a material shift, but culturally we're in a different kind of politics. It's definitely the whole end of history narrative is completely blown out of the water. And I think something new is developing, whether or not that's good or bad, we're gonna have to be able to analyze. But you can certainly see that there are definitely political shifts that are going on. It's hard because it's you focus too much on the rhetoric and you get lost, because then you're being controlled by whatever they're trying to present to you, which is always different from what they're actually doing. But I mean, it's definitely massive. I think that there's definitely something going on.
Absolutely.
You just watched a Michael Brooks Show video. Subscribe to get them all. Why wouldn't you? Don't be foolish. Click subscribe below and become a patron as well. Patreon.com/TMBS. Thanks, everybody.
Let me, you know, speaking of which, guys, can we just take a few minutes? The great Anna Kasparian just pointed this. Just pointed our way to this. It should be in the show outline. This Twitter thread on Dave Rubin's new book. Do we have that, guys?
Yeah, I can get it. Just one second. You put it in the thread. Set it up. I'll get it.
Yeah. So basically, Dave Rubin has a new book out, and
itself, like, that's the punchline. Dave Rubin.
That is already pretty funny. And I am burdened. I am totally burned out on talking about, and, you know, I mean, whatever. Dave Rubin is always going to be funny. It's always going to be some source of entertainment. But, you know, I there was a period of time where, to me, for a couple of months, Dave was like, he was the human version of Donald Trump pretending to drink water like Marco Rubio. he's funny, whatever. But that being said, this book, and I don't know if we have this thread up.
It's coming. Sorry.
This thread is masterful. And I think we might need to do a reading series. Speaking of which, we've got this.
Yeah.
All right. Let's read a little bit from this. All right. This is from at Seventh Degree UK. It's midnight here, and I've just started reading Don't Burn This Book by Dave Rubin, trying to keep my observations on this thread, follow along for the ride. We're not off to a good start. Dave Rubin has already managed to misspell Steven Crowder's name as Steven in chapter one. Now, look, that's not his fault. That's proofreader.
That's something that, like, I get nervous about when I'm doing YouTube titles, and I just feel like getting corrected over Steven Crowder's name might be one of the most devastating experiences of my life.
Oh my God. This guy is such a pain. I love it. In a recent interview with Charlie Kirk, he told Kirk that he only used the phrase regressive left once in the book. He actually put it in twice. This is a tacit admission that his ghostwriter is responsible. That is so, yo, this is so petty that I'm defending Dave. At this point, only two chapters into Dave Rubin's new book, Don't Burn This Book, and I've already accepted I'm going to be a broken man by the time I finish. Check out this stand-ups comics, Fresh Zingers. This is from Dave Rubin's book. We're going to have to do a reading series. They say the first step to recovery is admitting it. They say the first step to recovery is admitting there's a problem. This therapist believes is crucial because denial ain't just a river in Egypt. It's something that people keep being trapped in a cycle of dysfunction.
Okay.
There's no change ever. Oh, shit.
That's amazing. I'm sorry. That kind of writing takes balls to put a pun like that into a book. Like, that's a ballsy move.
I'm just going
to
cover our ass and say, like, I hope Seventh isn't winding us up here as the people in the UK. Like,
yeah, I hope. Yeah.
If this is a fake,
that would be really funny, honestly.
Don't wind us up, Seventh. We don't know. We don't have the text in front of us. Oh my God, I'm just reading. And the next page, I think this might be the first book that I will need therapy after reading. This is the best material a former stand-up comic could come up with. I might need something a bit stronger than a glass of opinions to get through the rest of this. All right, this is the final.
Okay.
All right. That's right. That's right, people. I want you to walk into a bar and order yourselves a full-bodied opinion. I want you to get absolutely wasted on facts until 3 a.m. And then when you're just about ready to pass out, I want you to get another large glass of reality and chug it. Now, I just want to say that I recently had an interaction with some guy who was still, like in 2020, post-corona, bitching at us for having some fun with Dave. And I was really politely, I said, look, if you're really interested in ideas, you should go watch our illicit history videos. Like, we actually deal with some like things in this channel, like talk about international relations. We do pretty deep dives on economics. Like, we have like actual conversations if you're actually interested in those things. But I reserve the right to read that graph on every single show for at least the rest of the year. Well, that may be the fun. I think if I was 11, I would have been like, I can't tell you why that shouldn't go out, but it doesn't sound right.
I don't know. I'm gonna give you something to think about. You might not know this, so this might make you feel a little bad about making fun of Dave.
Yes.
Did you know he was gay?
Anna and I were actually realizing on the last Jacobin show, we were just like, the way he uses it is like, and I've got left-wing positions, like I have sex with men, like to just start to be like, I support Medicare for all, but I'm pretty right-wing, like I'm straight, like can't really pigeonhole me. Yeah.
That's so good, man. That's so good.
Get wasted on facts.
Until 3 a.m.
And take a chunk of reality.
That's so good, man. That's... Yeah. I mean, I'm Dennis.
Dennis and I were up to 3 a.m. on cigars and facts just getting rowdy.
I wonder what a serious reader thinks of that book.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't imagine paying for that book.
A serious reader who gave Against the Web such a thoughtful review.
But like, this is amazing because it's just like, you wonder who the actual audience is of his book. Like, we know who they are, right? Mm. Kind of like annoying pedants or whatever, but could you, like, I could not, even in like the darkest periods of my life, the dumbest, like when I was 14, 15 years old, logic idiot guy, picking up a book and reading, stay up till 3 a.m., drinking facts, and then chug a glass of reality, right? And thinking I had made a good decision with my money or my time. Oh. I can't like, subject us anymore. This is pretty wild, though.
That's amazing.
You just watched a Michael Brooks Show video. Subscribe to get them all. Why wouldn't you? Don't be foolish. Click subscribe below and become a patron as well. Patreon.com/TMBS. Thanks, everybody.
usually when I go on I-24, we've played it sometimes. In fact, if you haven't looked, watched it, you can either go back in the post-game archive, or I think we clipped it as Michael Brooks debates a Mayo brain.
Who came up with that title?
Nation of Islam Obama. Like, literally.
Okay.
I said that in character, and then I was like, you know what? That works.
Gotcha.
So, fucking Mayo brain.
Didn't know if we wanted to shout out Forrest, but gotcha.
No, I think I think that was literally Nation of Islam Obama, which is basically my deep subconscious. And so, but usually when I go on I-24, it's like, you know, Michael, you're going to be talking about whether or not Trump is a criminal, and you're going to be talking with, you know, Jack Bickle, who's a ham wave radio operator who really likes Trump and the Bible. And, you know, but this debate on Ilhan Omar, I was up against, well, let me just put it this way. I was up against the guy with an accent, which is, as I point out in the clip, a huge disadvantage. But, let's play a couple minutes of it. We'll stop, and everybody can stop with their feed. I know Grisham had some feedback on this, but this is actually legit. You might learn from this if you're dealing with people who are smearing Ilhan Omar.
Joining us now is Michael Brooks, host of The Michael Brooks Show and co-host of The Majority Report, and David Efyun, editor-in-chief of The Allgemeiner. David, this was a victory, you would acknowledge, for progressives and perhaps something of a setback for staunch supporters of Israel.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. But, you know, problematic in a number of ways. And I think perhaps what it was the first sign of is what Bret Stephens called today the Corbynization of the Democratic Party.
Pause it.
This is something that...
At this point, I'm already like, fuck you.
Bret Stephens.
Bret Stephens, automatic. I honestly... was on the border of Bret Stephens in the debate. Okay.
The Democratic Party has got to be very careful about where the radical extremes, fringes of the party start to move towards the center and the mainstream and take control over some of what the party stands for. This is not the historic nature of what the Democratic Party stands for, and I think it's a great shame and tragedy that somebody like Ilhan Omar, who is an overt anti-Semite, can hold Democratic Party by the kahunas, as they say. Michael?
Well, I just want to note, first of all, you're always at a bit of a disadvantage.
Maybe we should rewind it a little bit, because he mispronounced it, but I'm assuming people laugh. I didn't even realize how dismissive I was in my body language there. It's actually kind of funny.
Party. By the kahunas, as they say. Michael?
Well, I just want to note, first of all, you're always at a bit of a disadvantage when you're up against an accent. So I just want to have that noted in the playing field. But let's be real here. I mean, there was one group that wasn't included in that resolution, and that was the Palestinians as a people, where regular racism and dehumanization towards them is entirely accepted. The reality is that Ilhan Omar is correct on the merits. She's correct on the policy. Saying that she said this comment about dual allegiance is a great leap to begin with. And I have to say, I find it extraordinary that people on the right, who sometimes accurately, by the way, not always, but sometimes accurately, say people on the left, you know, jump to accusations too quickly of various bigotries and read into things. They've been reading into every single thing that the Congresswoman has said from the beginning, most of which are substantive critiques of a sovereign nation state that happens to administer a horrific regime that violates people's rights on a daily basis in Gaza, the West Bank, and even inside Israel in some respects. The new indictment about Netanyahu isn't just garden variety corruption. It involves actually undermining democracy. So I support Ilhan Omar. I don't buy, and I also, in fact, support Corbyn, in fact. And the reality is that these things are going to become debated on the merits, and we're not going to have a false equivalency and actually drag down the profoundly serious issue of anti-Semitism by equating it with all criticism of a sovereign nation state that administers apartheid in reality.
Look, I
forgot to say, as a Jew.
So that's true, but I'm tired of playing that game. Like, I know you are, but I mean, like, I do have a critique of identity politics, frankly. And I do think that part of my real allergy does go back to conversations about Israel, where just identity and standpoint epistemology superseded everything else. And we can all walk and chew gum at the same time. If you're not indulging in anti-Semitism, and it's pretty obvious when people are, frankly, you should be able to have an opinion and a robust critique of Israel. And you know, this actually, and in my mind, it applies to plenty of other categories, right? Like, no one is going to say, like, oh, you're anti-Muslim if you can, you know, can critique the record of Saudi Arabia or the Iranian government. It's ridiculous. Now, you can tell here, he's a little bit thrown because I think he's very much used to debating a kind of typical Democrat who would say, like, well, this is a complicated issue. Mm-hmm. And he's thrown, you know, and I joke about the accent, but there's a lot of, like, fake authority in that accent. And he speaks very confidently and he's super articulate. But watch how not necessarily calm he stays after I say all that.
Almost, it's quite astounding to hear somebody sit here and speak like this. I mean,
speaking,
you know,
a
recent poll came out that only 24% of British people do not consider Corbyn to be an anti-Semite.
Well, so you guys have done an exceptional job, but let's focus on Omar. You've done a great job of smearing Corbyn.
But you know what, let's
you're not going to do this to Congresswoman Omar. Focus on her. Don't worry about it.
Let's do that.
Let me try to do that. Let's try to do this, and let me set this up. Let's focus on Omar.
Because this is important. This is really important.
And one of the issues, David, that she has argued is, and look, we can agree that maybe she was sloppy, maybe she got too close to an anti-Semitic trope, but as far as the actual policy is concerned, you mentioned a minute ago that the Democrats are engaged in something radical. Is it radical to criticize the Netanyahu government in Israel for the settlement policy in the West Bank?
Let's be clear about something, okay? And this is what's incredibly disingenuous about what you've just heard here. That is absolutely not what she is being accused of by people on the right and by members of her own party, the leadership of her own party. She is somebody who has accused Israel of hypnotizing the world.
That
has
was accused a 2012 supporters,
has
tweet,
accused
which
supporters.
She has already backtracked
excuse
on.
Me, I no. let you speak.
Right, don't touch
let me finish, please.
Sure.
Excuse me.
She has
accused supporters of the Jewish state of being motivated by money. And she has
every
accused,
lobby plays
she has
a role
accused
in
the largest,
that's reality.
The largest pro-Israel Jewish organization.
Right, that's a resolution condemning her for that. But again, again to my question, is it radical to criticize the Netanyahu government for their settlement policy in the West Bank?
That's not what this discussion is
that's
about.
That's absolutely what this
is
discussion
radical?
Is about.
It's not,
this
it's
discussion
not
is about the role
but that
of lobbyists.
Is not what this discussion
hold
about.
On.
That's not
this
what
discussion is about the power of
that's
lobbies.
That's not what she's being criticized
before. This
discussion
is about money and politics. This discussion is about foreign policy in the Middle East. Also, Ilhan Omar has been a robust critic of Saudi Arabia. She said people should boycott the Hajj because of Saudi Arabia's conduct. The reality is that the old stagnant frames of both the sort of Saudi and Israeli consensus is being undermined and disrupted and critiqued in a robust way, which is oriented on global human rights standards and not, in fact, ethnocentric identity politics, which is a problem wherever it manifests. And the smearing of her, the lies about her, the disgusting, grotesque display against her you just saw is only going to strengthen people's commitment.
I didn't realize I did this, but it's visually kind of funny. Just go back just like a few seconds. Well, this is another thing, too, is don't worry about looking polite. I think you got to hold your tone and have a certain niceness about you. But, like, look, he's saying bullshit. Interrupt.
Ethnocentric identity politics, which is a problem wherever it manifests. And the smearing of her, the lies about her, the disgusting, grotesque display against her you just saw is only going to strengthen people's commitment.
But can you understand why a lot of people who support Israel, they may criticize the Netanyahu government, feel that Israel constantly gets singled out by people on the Democratic left in a way that is unfair compared to the rest of the world?
So in terms of reality, let's break this down. Number one, there is... First of all, if Israel wants to be held to a higher standard than a place like Saudi Arabia, it's going to be held to a higher standard. When people say, well, why don't you complain about the Saudis? First of all, everybody does, and the Saudis at least don't have any pretensions that they're anything other than a brutal theocracy and monarchy. The Israelis have maintained a position of being the only democracy in the Middle East, while they have maintained an occupation of another group of people for over 40 years and regularly killed and bombed civilians. And the second standard is that, look, again, in terms of reality, Israel
has not only serious and profound and systemic problems, which even poses a threat in some respects to our security, but like Egypt, we happen to fund them greatly. And so therefore, it is a different relationship. But you will find that those who criticize Israel in good faith, as many Jewish activists do, of course, are going to be actually the same people, as you see with Omar, who are questioning the relationship with the Gulf monarchies and other areas of dysfunction in Middle East policy that will never be wrong, no matter how many lies and smears people throw at her.
You know, we can have a long discussion about Middle East policy.
Pause it.
But what you
this is where he's lost it. This is where he's lost it. And I'm not, and again, I'm really just like, I'll try to find one where I've fucked up because this isn't like, it's fun, whatever. But this is it. If you're in this engagement with somebody and somebody else is watching, the constant goalpost shifting, and he's still trying to use that tone of like, I've got this under control here, but he's done.
How many lies and smears people throw at her?
You know, we can have a long discussion about Middle East policy, but what you have seen tonight is disingenuity and the highest level.
I agree.
This is not what this discussion is about. This is not about
policy. So,
please don't interrupt. I let you speak. Please don't interrupt.
And focus on policy.
Please don't interrupt.
Focus on
this
policy.
This is about a person who has come into the United States Congress and repeated, as a repeat offender, bigoted tropes against the Jewish community. She's been called out from it across the board, from within the Jewish community, from within her own party. And
the concern is... people who agree with you, and look, there are plenty of people who do agree with you and may say that, you know, what she did was unconscionable, but by playing it out the way it did, by hitting back so hard at Ilhan Omar, who doesn't seem like any sort of threat to Israel or people who support Israel, the Israeli right has essentially lifted her stature. She has more power now than she did a week ago.
Well, but also, let's be clear, most
about the Israeli right, right? The criticism here is coming from across the political spectrum, and it's a very specific criticism. This is not criticism about discussion of Israel. It's criticism about repeating anti-Semitic tropes.
And it's
that's the charge of dual loyalty. That's the charge of being influenced by money.
Which we don't accept that premise.
Right? And that's the charge of Israel hypnotizing the world.
And every single person.
Kind of tropes that you saw
every
in Nazi
single
propaganda.
Person is in this was definitely rude, but I saw the 1 minute warning and I never leave these things without getting the last word.
Hypnotizing
single,
the world
and every single
these are the
person,
kind of tropes that you saw
every
in Nazi
single
propaganda.
Person is influenced by money from every single lobby. There's no magical exemption with AIPAC, and she's right.
Michael Brooks and David Effian, good to have you both on. Terrific discussion. We appreciate it.
Yes.